True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
Jennifer Farber Dulos was a woman to be envied. Educated and attractive, she came from a wealthy New York City family, lived in beautiful Connecticut mansions, married a handsome, educated man, and had 5 healthy children. After 13 years of marriage to her Greek-American husband, Fotis Dulos, he became aggressive and unfaithful. He told Jennifer that he had fallen out of love with her, but he didn't want to move out of the family home. Instead, he wanted to move his new lover and her daughter in with them. One big happy family.
Sounds like a plan.
But not surprisingly, Jennifer was not on board with this plan.
I can imagine she wasn't.
So what she did is she moved out under the cover of the night, taking the kids with her. Join us at the quiet end as we discuss the disappearance of Jennifer Dulos. When Jennifer vanished, she and Fotis were still deeply entrenched in a lengthy and intense divorce battle. As Jennifer tried to move forward and focus on her children, Fotis was starting to realize that he could lose custody of his children and go bankrupt. Although he denied having any involvement in his estranged wife's disappearance, a trail of evidence would reveal dark and sinister secrets.
So today's beer is one called Too Juicy, from Two Roads Brewing Company in Stratford, Connecticut. This is a New England IPA, 8.2% alcohol by volume. This beer is a hazy gold color, smallish head, little bit of lace, the aromas of some citrus, some pine, and caramel. And it's got a grapefruit, tangerine, pine, and caramel taste. It's a medium-bodied beer, way too easy to drink because you don't know that it's 8.2%.
Creeps up on you.
It sneaks right up.
Well, it sounds delicious, so let's open a couple bottles, huh?
We can each have a bottle, sure.
Okay. Okay, Dickie, come over here and join me and the puppy. He's pretty good now with his little bone, and I'm ready to talk about this case. This is a case we've been following since it happened, which is a bit over a year ago, year and a half-ish.
Yeah, that's right. We've thought about it and thought about it, and you finally pulled the trigger.
Yes. Well, there was a lot to learn about it, for sure.
Hey, so Jennifer was born in New York in September of 1968 to Gloria and Hillard Farber. She grew up in Brooklyn Heights. Her father was a vice president at Chase Manhattan Bank, and eventually he founded his own company. Her mother had a doctorate in early childhood education and was very passionate about teaching. Jennifer's aunt and uncle were also very wealthy as the founders of Liz Claiborne Fashions. Jennifer had a sister named Melissa, just the one sister. The girls grew up in a very comfortable environment. Very comfortable.
I would say so.
So Jennifer went to Brown for an undergraduate degree. And then she attended a postgraduate writing program at New York University and eventually earned a master's degree. Now, her family's wealth made it possible for Jennifer to travel and to live the writer's lifestyle. After 9/11, she left Manhattan and she drove cross-country with her King Charles Spaniel. She'd had many dates and several boyfriends through her 20s and early 30s, but it wasn't until 2003 when she decided she'd found the man to settle down and raise a family with. At the Aspen airport, she bumped into a former Brown classmate, Fotis Dulos, and they made plans to see each other after they returned to New York. Although Fotis didn't come from money, he had an appealing personality, and he knew how to fit into the upper echelon of society. He was an immigrant, he was hardworking, charming, athletic, educated, and a good-looking guy.
Yeah, Fotis had built a successful career as a financial consultant since graduating from Brown. He was born in Turkey and he grew up in Athens, moving to the U.S. in 1986. He graduated from Brown 1 year before Jennifer and then earned an MBA in finance from Columbia. In 2000, Fotis married Hillary Aldama. So this marriage lasted just 4 years, ending in a divorce just 1 month before Fotis married Jennifer. So there was probably a little bit of an overlap going on there.
So it would seem, right?
I would think.
And that doesn't give people a little brief pause to think about, you know, there's this guy who's been married 4 years, he's divorced, and now we're getting married quickly?
I don't know. I mean, it happens to decent people, certainly.
True, I guess.
In August of 2004, Fotis and Jennifer were married in an opulent Manhattan wedding. They moved from Manhattan to Farmington, Connecticut to settle in and start a family. It took some time and some fertility treatments, but they eventually had 5 children. Twins in 2006, another set of twins in 2008, and a daughter in 2010. In many ways, Jennifer was like other suburban moms, driving the kids to school, signing them up for art classes, music lessons, horseback riding, and tennis. Fotis was in love with water skiing, and he began living a more independent life, while Jennifer really leaned into being a full-time mom. By the time they were 9 years old, the elder twins were top-ranked water skiers, and Dulos skied every chance he got, loving the challenge of competitive sports. Water skiing became an obsession for him, really, but Jennifer wasn't a fan. She didn't enjoy it. She once wrote that skiing hurt her back, and it just made her feel like the opposite of limber.
You don't want to do that. If it hurts and you feel stiff, it's not for you.
No.
Now, Fotis's professional life was a bit on the chaotic side. He really liked the rush of a deadline and completing a project at the last minute. He ended up starting his own custom home building business called the Four Group, and this company developed large executive homes, most of them over 10,000 square feet. He had his office in the family home.
But Jennifer, understandably, found parenting 5 young children stressful and exhausting.
I'll bet.
I mean, she was 50 by the time she was having to take care of these kids. When the children were little, Fotis moved the family from one home to another, too. So they'd live in these new, unsold model homes while his company was building the next one. And these houses were huge, so it was too big to just temporarily furnish them completely and decorate them. So they would partially, at least, live out of cardboard boxes. So with little kids, that's tough.
It sure is. It's almost like a gypsy lifestyle.
Well, yeah, but it's luxurious at the same time.
Well, maybe for him. I'm telling you, this woman had 5 kids in 4 years, and she's the caretaker.
Yes.
She probably did have some help, but she was the primary caretaker.
Have quite a bit of help. They had lots of money.
Okay.
But yeah, she still wanted to be a hands-on mom, and I'm sure it was a lot of work. Now you get kind of secluded from the outside world.
Yeah, you do. And Fotis, for his part, seems like his focus was on work and water skiing.
Yes, absolutely.
And there wasn't much time for anything else.
Right. So when Fotis finally designed a permanent home for the family, it was larger and more luxurious than any of the homes that came before it. Located at 4 Jefferson Crossing in Farmington, this brick home was over 14,000 square feet with 6 bedrooms and 7 bathrooms. But it wasn't enough to save the marriage. Money and luxury can only get you so far. Jennifer was getting lonely, almost like a single mom. As an experienced writer, she began writing parenting blogs, sharing the ups and downs of parenthood, trying to express herself. But the marriage went through a slow, inevitable decline. In 2012, Jennifer wrote in one of her blog posts that she wished she were strong and not fearful of confrontation. The more the couple grew apart and argued, the more Jennifer turned to the kids for love and companionship. On a blog that she started called 5 + 2 = 7, Jennifer wrote about the joys and the difficulties of motherhood. In these entries, trouble between she and Fotis could kind of be read between the lines. She wrote about conflict and her need for calm and quiet. She also gave advice to other women to never be second to anyone else, which is a difficult thing for wives and mothers.
There was also a tragedy in a family after Fotis's parents moved to the United States from Athens. The family nanny accidentally ran over Fotis's mother with a car. Now, his mom was hospitalized for a short time before she died of her injuries.
So that's traumatic.
Boy, that's very traumatic.
Especially for the nanny, maybe. I mean, how do you get over that?
That's tough. I mean, this is your employer, and you've just killed his mother, or run over.
Yeah.
That's a tough one.
It really is, yes. So after that, Fotis became more distant. He was often away on water skiing trips for up to 10 days a month. He enjoyed traveling on private planes with friends, basically living the life of a bachelor. He also became a controlling and abusive husband. He began putting down Jennifer's friends and urging her to lose contact with them. Jennifer's father suffered from an autoimmune disease, and Jennifer tried to spend some more time with her parents then. But Jennifer's family and friends started to worry about Fotis's increasing aggression. His control and pushing of the kids to water ski became a point of contention. The kids were actually exhausted and begged Jennifer to let them quit. But she was beginning to live in fear of Fotis, so she didn't have a lot of power either. Now, he was very difficult to be with at times. For example, at one point, he punched out a parking lot attendant. Jennifer's father died in 2017, leaving Jennifer in grief with not much support, certainly not from her husband. Then she learned that Fotis was having an affair with a Venezuelan woman named Michelle Traconis. Traconis worked as a marketing agent for high-end resorts, and she was also a very good water skier. Divorced with a teenage daughter, Michelle Traconis was athletic and she traveled the world. So she was kind of the opposite of how Jennifer was at this point, because Jennifer was at home with the kids, and she was very bookish. She liked to stay home and read and do things with the children. And Fotis really showed no interest in that.
Yeah, because Fotis was telling Jennifer that he'd fallen out of love with her. However, he still wanted her and the children to live with him. But at the same time, he wanted to move Michelle Traconis and her teenage daughter in with them at the house at 4 Jefferson Crossing.
Well, there's plenty of room.
There certainly is. It's going to be one big happy family, at least in his mind.
Yeah, that takes some nerve to even suggest that.
I can't believe it. You obviously know that Jennifer would not be okay with that.
No, of course not. That summer, Jennifer and Fotis got into an argument, and Fotis chased her around the house. Jennifer ended up hiding in a bathroom with one of the children, and the nanny was there, Lauren Almeida. He only calmed down and walked away after he learned that the nanny was there with her. Lauren was also present one day when Fotis tried to run Jennifer over with his car. So Lauren had heard screaming from the driveway area of the house and came out to find Jennifer, looking very shaken and crying. And she told Lauren that Fotis had tried to run her over. But for multiple reasons or whatever reason we don't know for sure, she did not call the police.
Again, hindsight is so good, isn't it?
Yeah.
We're seeing some escalation in this guy's behaviors.
Absolutely.
Seems like a good time to call the police after he's attempted to run you over.
Doesn't it?
But, like you said, for whatever reason, she didn't.
Sure. I'm sure she had some reasons.
So the arguments continued to grow more and more intense. Jennifer and Fotis had come to an agreement to keep guns out of their house, with young kids in the house. But Jennifer then learned from her children that Fotis had purchased a gun, a 9mm Glock. He had showed the gun to his older children, and he had never consulted Jennifer about buying it. So to her, this was the last straw. Jennifer was afraid for her life and the lives of her kids.
Yeah, I think she was really terrified at this point. In June of 2017, she made a plan to leave. In the middle of the night, she gathered the kids into the car along with their necessary belongings. She filed for a divorce and rented a large home in New Canaan. This put her about halfway between Farmington and where her mother lived in New York. The couple had planned to expand the four group, so they had applied for the kids to attend the New Canaan Country School. By staying in New Canaan, the kids' lives were not terribly disrupted, but Jennifer was really terrified. As we know, abused spouses are most at risk when they leave the abuser. But after she left, Fotis called 911 and reported his family missing. He also reported that Jennifer had stolen things from him.
And now Jennifer was smart enough to file for emergency custody of the kids. The divorce was going to be complex and difficult. She already knew that. Fotis was enraged, and he felt that Jennifer was trying to turn the kids against him. He also had outstanding loans from Jennifer's parents, with a balance of at least $1.5 million. And Jennifer's mother, Gloria, had already filed a lawsuit to get the money repaid. No love lost there.
Well, from my understanding, when Jennifer's father died, he stopped making payments on the loan. And Gloria didn't like that. She'd asked him to make some payments, and he just hadn't done it. And it could be more than $1.5 million. I think the loan started out at being $2.5-ish. So it was a lot of money. I mean, anyone who can even afford to loan that much money is super wealthy.
Right.
But Fotis might have known that the divorce and custody battles wouldn't go his way. Still, he didn't seem prepared for what happened. He'd been unfaithful, he'd bought a gun, and he'd shown some real rage towards his wife. He'd also gained a lot from the Farber family's wealth, Jennifer's family. So it began to look like he would go bankrupt and probably lose custody of his children. Also, his gun was taken away from him because he hadn't registered it. So after Jennifer had moved out, Fotis moved Michelle and her daughter into the Jefferson Crossing home pretty quickly.
Well, he was planning on doing that anyway.
That's true. You're right. That's awful. But this divorce was expensive, and it went on and on. Records include over 300 court motions. When Fotis spent time with his children and his girlfriend Michelle and told the children to lie to their mother, his visits were changed to include supervision with a court-appointed guardian ad litem. And, of course, he wasn't happy about that at all.
I'm sure that sat well with him. Sure, he really, really is happy to have that ruling. Jennifer alleged that on June 3rd, 2017, Fotis became enraged. He appeared to be out of control, and he blamed her for scheduling activities for the children on a Saturday morning. So she's afraid. She's trying to leave the room. Then Fotis followed her upstairs and into a bedroom, where he shut the door and blocked it, so that she was trapped, as he verbally attacked her and physically intimidated her.
Well, Fotis stated that he never physically threatened, stalked, or assaulted his wife. He also said that his wife called him a psychopath and told the children that he doesn't care about them. Also, Fotis claimed that his wife said to the children, "I will make sure this divorce takes 2.5 years. I can have the mafia break your dad's legs with a baseball bat." But I have to tell you, that doesn't sound like her. She doesn't really seem like the kind of person that would say something like that, especially to her children.
No.
In divorce documents, Jennifer wrote, "I know that filing for divorce will enrage him. I know he will retaliate by trying to harm me in some way." And she also alleged that Fotis had threatened to kidnap their children if she didn't agree to his terms in the divorce settlement. So in January 2018, she requested an emergency custody order again, after Fotis repeatedly broke court orders. In March, Jennifer was awarded sole physical custody, supervised visits were continued, and all of his phone calls with his children were monitored. And this was because Fotis had been trying to get his children to lie for him with the court. So, it's just a terrible thing to do, to manipulate your children like that.
Yeah, this has just deteriorated into a horrendous battle.
Yeah.
So on May 18, 2019, a shallow grave was discovered at the Windsor Gun and Rod Club in New Granby, Connecticut. The club is 25 acres of wooded land, exclusive for its very rich members to hunt and fish there. Two hunters came across this man-made hole with a blue tarp and barbecue grates over it. It looked like whoever dug the hole was trying to cover it up. The hole was 6 feet long, 3 feet deep, had a couple bags of lime sitting inside.
It really did look like a grave.
Yeah, now the two hunters who found the hole didn't really think too much about it, and they just continued on with their day. But the hole might have been for Jennifer Dulos's body.
Yeah, it could have been part of a murder plot.
But it never was used.
Well, no, because it was found.
Yeah.
On May 22nd, Lauren the nanny was at Jennifer's house in New Canaan, as they waited for Fotis and the visitation supervisor to arrive. He was supposed to take the kids to Grace Farms Nature Center for a picnic from 4:30 to 7:30 p.m. At 4 p.m., Fotis showed up and said he had the time wrong. And once the supervisor arrived, he took the children to Grace Farms. But Grace Farms was only open until 6 p.m., so then he called Jennifer and asked if they could have the last hour and a half of the visit in the yard at her house. Jennifer agreed because she felt safe with the supervisor there and with him outside of the house. Lauren and the supervisor said that Jennifer kept the doors locked the entire time and Fotis didn't step one foot inside that house because, as required, the supervisor stayed at the home until after Fotis had left. And this is important because it tells us that there was no chance that Fotis had been inside of that house when he could have left DNA, because remember, she'd rented this house. There's no reason why he should have ever been in it.
Right. And he hadn't been in it, as far as we know, right?
Exactly, right. But he would try and claim he was in it later.
Yeah.
When his DNA was found.
When his DNA was found.
Exactly.
Sure. You got to fit the story to the evidence.
Yes.
But he had not ever been in that house.
No.
On May 23rd, Jennifer discussed with Lauren that maybe she should spend the night because Jennifer had doctor appointments in New York City the next day. But then she decided that wasn't necessary because she had enough time to take the kids to school the next morning and drive to the city in time for her appointments. So she said that she would leave the Suburban at the house and take the Range Rover into the city, because it was easier to park that car. When Lauren left Jennifer that night, the plan was for her to return to the house and pick up the kids from school in the middle of the day and then bring them to the city to be with Jennifer.
Yes, so on May 24th, Jennifer did drop her kids off at school at 8 a.m. At 8:05, she pulled into her driveway in the Suburban, drove into the garage, and the door closed by remote behind her. A neighbor's security camera caught footage of the car arriving. Then, at 10:25 a.m., the Suburban was seen by the same camera leaving the house. So that's like, what, 2 hours, 20 minutes?
Right.
So her appointment in New York City, though, was at 10:30. So
well,
she should have left.
She's not going to make that.
Yeah, she should have left a lot earlier. So if she was actually leaving for her appointment at 10:25, she would have been very late.
She would have. And she was driving the car that she said was going to stay behind. She's going to take the Range Rover.
Exactly.
But someone's driving the Suburban.
Yes.
Then at 11:30, Lauren Almeida arrived at Jennifer's rental house. She went in through the garage by using the keypad. And right away, she began to find things that were not normal. The Suburban was missing from the garage, but the Range Rover was still there. And Lauren remembered that Jennifer had told her she'd be taking the Range Rover to the city that day. She also found Jennifer's purse in the house as well, in a kind of weird position. It was on the floor between the mudroom and the kitchen.
Well, yeah, nobody would purposely put their purse on the floor.
No. So why would she drive to the city without her purse?
Well, it doesn't make any sense.
And why would it be left on the floor there?
I mean, as far as taking the Suburban and not the Range Rover, she could have just changed her mind.
Sure.
But the purse was more strange and concerning.
Yes, definitely is.
And in addition to that, Lauren saw Jennifer's travel mug filled with tea next to an unopened granola bar on the kitchen counter. So that would have been her quick breakfast that she probably would have brought with her. So why was that left there? I mean, it's possible that she just forgot it, but all of these little things really are adding up to a big thing.
Yeah, this nanny or helper, she's thinking something's wrong here.
I think so. I mean, not really panicked at this point, but things are just seeming weird.
Yes.
So she was washing out the tea mug, and she used up the last paper towel on the roll. And when she opened the pantry to get a new roll, she saw there were just two rolls left. So this is significant because Lauren herself had stocked the pantry with a dozen rolls just the day before. And she really couldn't imagine what could have happened at the house that would have caused Jennifer to use 10 rolls of paper towels. It's hard to think of a circumstance where that would even happen. If you had that big of a spill, normally you'd use a towel, a real towel.
I would think.
Like a bath towel.
Uh-huh.
That's a lot of paper towels. So she kind of let that go too, along with the other things, and went ahead and picked up the children at school at noon. And that was the routine. It was half a day. She fed them lunch back at the house, and then she started texting Jennifer repeatedly, beginning at 12:43. And she didn't get any reply, which was very unusual. Lauren got the kids ready for the drive to the city, but then she noticed another thing. The back mudroom door was unlocked. And that's not something that happened either. Jennifer always kept the doors locked. She was kind of obsessive about it. The only time before when Lauren had seen that door unlocked was when the kids were playing outside and they were running in and out. But it couldn't be unlocked for that reason because they'd been at school all day.
That's right.
So there's no reason for that door to be unlocked. So we have several strange things here. We have that she took a different car, that her purse is on the floor, which is probably the most alarming, that the door is unlocked, that her tea and the granola bar are still sitting there. Plus, maybe the most alarming thing to Lauren was that she wasn't hearing back from Jennifer.
Right, and she's texting her repeatedly.
Yeah.
And not getting any response.
So Lauren did lock that door, and at 1:10 she texted Jennifer to tell her that they would be in the city by 2:30. She didn't get a response from Jennifer, but she went ahead and drove the kids into the city. When she got to New York, she and the kids went to Jennifer's mother, Gloria's apartment, and she texted Jennifer to let her know that they'd arrived. So at 4:00, after still getting no response, then Laura called. She called Jennifer's cell phone, which went straight to voicemail. So Lauren had never been unable to reach Jennifer before in the 7 years that she had worked for her, so that's significant. It's more than unusual, it's unheard of.
Two of the kids had an orthodontist appointment at 4:40 in the afternoon. Lauren was not sure what to do, so she went ahead to the appointment, hoping she would see Jennifer there. But when Jennifer was a no-show, Lauren started having a pretty bad feeling, and her first thought, admittedly a dark one, was that Fotis had done something to Jennifer. So Lauren started calling Jennifer's friends, trying to reach her. None of the friends had heard from her. So we're getting a little more panicky here.
Well, yeah, now it's definitely a problem. Just before 7 p.m., Lauren and another friend of Jennifer's called the New Canaan police and reported that Jennifer was missing. They let the police know that Jennifer was in the middle of a difficult divorce and also that her husband had threatened her in the past and that he owned a gun. So I think when people's minds go there and they know a relationship pretty well, it's concerning. I think that gut feeling you get is usually true.
Yeah, listen to your gut.
Yes.
Jill, what are you burning out here? Bodies?
Well, no. I'm throwing in all of our earbuds and headphones with a little bit of lighter fluid as my protest against podcast ads in my favorite shows. I'm just getting into a story, or I'm dozing off, and it's interrupted with commercials. I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore.
Nice movie reference. Anyway, let's just simmer down here. You do know that our True Crime Brewery listeners have the option to subscribe to our premium show for ad-free episodes and bonus episodes, right? It costs as little as $4 per month. And these contributions help support the cost of producing TCB.
Well, of course. I love and appreciate our subscribers. You know, I worked for weeks with our IT girl to set that up, and all because I have a deeply held belief that our listeners shouldn't have to hear ads.
That's well said. Now, let me ask you this. How are we going to record this week's episode without our headphones?
Oh, for fuck's sake.
Well, you stay here. I'll go get the hose.
Okay, hurry.
So at 8:41 that night, Lauren got a call from Fotis. She answered it after the police told her to, And Fotis said he'd just been contacted by the New Canaan police, and they told him that Jennifer was missing. He didn't seem concerned, and he didn't ask Lauren any questions about when Jennifer had last been seen. He expected Lauren to drive the kids back to Connecticut the next day, Saturday, for their visit with him, which was scheduled for 11 a.m. So Lauren told him that she would have to wait and see what the police wanted her to do about the planned visit, and he asked her to keep him updated about the situation.
Yeah, so after the police received the missing persons call from Lauren that Friday evening, the 24th, they sent two officers out to Jennifer's rental home. No one answered when they knocked on the front door, so they used the garage code, Lauren gave it to them, to get inside the three-car garage. So the Range Rover was still parked there, and the Suburban was still missing. The third area of the garage was used for kids' bikes and things like that, I believe. The officers noticed something, though, that looked like blood on the driver's side of the Range Rover. So they're looking more closely than Lauren did. They also saw a spatter on the garage floor on the driver's side. It looked like someone had cleaned up blood, leaving some smears. And the officers really thought homicide at this point, and they called the state police and the crime scene forensic unit. New Canaan actually had not had a murder since 2012, so 7 years.
Yeah, so we need to have the experts come investigate this.
Yeah, I think that's really the wise thing to do right away.
Absolutely. They searched the house thoroughly, and they found blood evidence in various places throughout the house and took swabs of all those. Then they found Jennifer's Suburban. It's found in Waverly Park, which is about 3 miles from her home. But no signs of Jennifer. She wasn't in the SUV. No sign of her in or near the car. Investigators called Fotis to let him know that his wife was missing. He told them that he had not seen or heard from Jennifer or the children at all that day. He continued to seem to be unconcerned, which is suspicious, but he did agree to come to the station the next day at 11 a.m. for an interview.
So the children ended up staying with their Grandma Gloria in New York City, and the next morning the search for Jennifer continued. Police were unable to locate her cell phone. According to Verizon, her cell phone had last pinged in the vicinity of Waverly Park at 11:09 a.m. on the 24th, the day she went missing. After that, it was disconnected from the network. So why would Jennifer's killer leave her cell phone in the Waverly Park area for those 40 minutes or so after parking the Suburban there? We don't know, but I would speculate that maybe the phone was left in the Suburban by Jennifer, and Fotis didn't find it there until after he had used a Tacoma that he borrowed from an employee to dispose of her body somewhere. So if this is the case, we can be pretty sure that Jennifer's body was disposed of within a 40-minute travel range of Waverly Park. And I don't think they would have done it right there at the park. They would have been seen if they spent that much time there disposing of a body. So the only other explanation would be that Jennifer herself drove the Suburban to the park and stayed there for 40 minutes before powering off her own phone and disappearing on her own. So that wasn't very likely.
That's not likely at all.
So at 11:12 p.m., the red Tacoma belonging to an employee of Fotis was recorded driving on the Merritt Parkway. In footage recorded as it drove past the New Canaan rest stop, the rim of a bicycle can be seen in the back. It's spotted driving north toward Farmington, and then it arrives at 80 Mountain Spring Road, another property owned by Fotis Doulos, at 12:22. And this all fits with the camera footage.
And then just after 1:30 p.m., a white Jeep and a black Suburban that was not Jennifer's arrived at the Mountain Spring Road property. In interviews with Traconis, she had said that she was driving the Jeep and Fotis was driving a Suburban. How did he drop off the Tacoma and then show up driving a Suburban? Well, it would only take about 40 minutes to walk, or even less time to jog to his house and get the Suburban.
Sure, so there's a lot of different cars in this story that they move back and forth. But primarily, we're interested in Jennifer's Suburban and the Tacoma. But there are a lot of vehicles. He owned a lot of vehicles for his business, apparently.
Yes.
So it wasn't until 1:37 p.m. when Fotis's cell phone pinged at the Mountain Spring property. Before that, it had been at the house on Jefferson Crossing, the house he was sharing with Michelle. According to both Fotis and Michelle, they were at the Mountain Spring property to clean it because some potential buyers were coming to see it. Michelle told police that Fotis came into the house at one point and asked her for some paper towels to clean up coffee he had spilled in the car. And when he brought them in, they had brownish stains on them. So he said he was cleaning up coffee, but it didn't smell like coffee. And police believe it could have been blood, although Michelle would never say that. But, you know, older blood would be brown.
Yeah, it's oxidized.
Yep.
So it wouldn't be bright red.
No.
Now, the Suburban was located at the park on the 24th at 8:10 p.m. by police. It had been left in reverse with the running lights on, and the rear cargo liner was missing.
Yeah, and there was blood evidence on the inside and the rear cargo area, as well as on the outside of the passenger door. So a search of this 300-acre park, including dogs and many police, found no trace of Jennifer. The evidence led investigators to believe that Jennifer had been attacked in her garage between the Suburban and the Range Rover, and that would explain why both vehicles had blood on them. And whoever attacked her apparently cleaned up blood with those 10 rolls of paper towels.
And police took dozens of pictures of the garage interior. And then they showed the photos to Lauren, hoping she would be able to identify if anything was missing. Lauren had cleaned the garage herself on May 21st, just 3 days before Jennifer disappeared. In a picture, she noticed that two white camping pillows were missing. And in another picture, she noticed that a bucket of cleaning supplies was missing.
So she's pretty helpful in this case. It's a good thing she was around.
She's pretty observant.
Yes. Fotis texted Lauren at 5:39 a.m. on May 25th, asking her about the visit with his kids that had been scheduled that day. She texted him back that she had no update from the police, and he texted a few more times trying to confirm that she would bring the kids back to Connecticut to visit him. But she did not bring them. She left them with their grandmother.
Fotis was late for his interview with the police. He finally arrived at the police station around 2:45, after having been expected, 11 to 12, somewhere in there. He walked into the station alone, but then told the police that his lawyer was outside talking on his phone. The police told Fotis they needed his help in locating his wife. Before taking him into an interview room, he was asked if he had any weapons on him. He went through his pockets and told him, "No weapons, but I can't find my phone." And as this was happening, his lawyer shows up and announces that there's not going to be an interview.
So, well, this was surprising to the police and didn't look good because he should be worried about his wife, even if they are estranged.
Yeah, isn't that right?
And while standing in the lobby talking, his lawyer had Fotis's phone and he handed it to Fotis. We don't know why he was in possession of that phone, but it's curious. The officers were really surprised that Fotis wouldn't speak with them, and they really tried to clarify this with his lawyer, why they didn't want to help find Jennifer. A detective asked Fotis for his phone, and Fotis did hand it to him and gave him the unlock code. The detective put the phone on airplane mode, which removes the phone from the network and prevents any data from being remotely erased.
Uh-huh. Clever.
Yeah. When the lawyer asked him what he was doing, the detective told him that he was securing the cell phone and the data because he believed it contained evidence. He said that a search and seizure warrant would be sought to authorize a search of the data. And the attorney said, well, you have no grounds to seize the phone without a warrant. But detectives knew that they could secure the phone to prevent destruction of evidence while they were waiting for the warrant to search it. So they were able to do that. And Fotis and his attorney left the station not super happy.
Yeah, I'll bet. On that same day at 8:50 p.m., the warrant was issued by the court. A forensic examination of Fotis's phone on the next day, May 26th, gave the police information that the phone had been in the area of Albany Avenue in Hartford, Connecticut, on the day Jennifer disappeared. The phone was at his house in Farmington on the morning Jennifer went missing. Then it moved between his house and a property he owned 5 minutes away, 80 Mountain Drive. And this was after 1 in the afternoon.
Yeah, I think that's the 137 ping that we were talking about.
Yes. To find out what Fotis was doing in Hartford, they began to pull CCTV footage.
So CCTV footage plays a huge role in this case.
It does. And I learned from whatever we were reading that Hartford is one of the cities with the most cameras of any.
Yeah, a lot.
A lot.
Yeah, plus they took footage off of school buses because school buses all have cameras. So they were able to track the different vehicles and the times. We won't get into too much detail because it's pretty boring, but they were able to track all that. Fotis texted the nanny, Lauren, on the 26th, and then he showed up at Jennifer's mother's apartment in New York demanding to see the children. They called the NYPD, and they came to the scene, and Fotis told them that his children had been abducted. But when they checked with the New Canaan police, they learned that Fotis only had supervised visits at very specific times. So he was told to leave. And he did. He did return again a few days later, but Gloria, by that time, had hired an armed guard.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, so having money is convenient sometimes.
She's playing hardball with
him. And the guard sent him away.
Then on May 27th, detectives began canvassing the areas of Fairmont Street and Albany Street in Hartford. This is when Fotis' phone had pinged on the evening of the 24th. They were able to find video footage of a large, dark-colored pickup truck, which matched the Ford Group's 2014 Ford Raptor, traveling in the area about 7:40 p.m. And on May 30th, detectives contacted the Hartford Police Department's Special Operations Unit and asked for assistance in following Fotis' activities in the Albany Avenue area. So the command center was able to locate footage of a man wearing a light-colored shirt, dark pants, and a baseball cap. And this man was determined to be Fotis Doulos.
So Fotis is seen driving the Raptor with a female passenger, who is later identified as Michelle Traconis. They mapped out his movements as they watched Fotis putting black plastic garbage bags into several different trash barrels over the evening of May 24th. So this mapping included, at 7:31 p.m., the Raptor entering the area of Albany Avenue. 1 minute later, the Raptor travels east along Albany Avenue and turns right onto Milford Street. And as the truck passes the camera's view, several plastic bags are seen in the rear bed of this pickup. The truck drives through the city streets and is off camera now for about 7 minutes, until 7:39. Then the Raptor is seen again on Albany Avenue traveling east. The truck stops at the corner of Albany and Garden Street, and Fotis gets out, grabs a plastic bag from the back of the pickup, and puts it into a trash barrel on the sidewalk there. And at this point, you can see that most of those bags are gone, so he's been depositing them. At 7:40, the truck passes the camera again, and you can see there is just one bag remaining in the back. At 7:41, Fotis is seen depositing the last bag into another trash receptacle. Then, at 7:50, the Raptor leaves the area, traveling west.
And then there's more footage that shows Fotis removing a large, rigid object from the back of the Raptor, which he leans up against a building. This object is consistent with a WeatherTech rear cargo liner that was missing from Jennifer's Suburban. A homeless man is later identified as a person who removed a light-colored piece of material with a large blood-like stain on it. This is consistent with one of the two camping pillows that were missing that Lauren had said had been in the garage. The homeless man said he did see the pillow, but he didn't keep it. He also claimed to have found a knife beneath the pillow, which he gave to a drug dealer in exchange for drugs. As far as we know, that dealer and the knife have not been found.
No, I guess he didn't know the name of the drug dealer, he said. So the detective's next step was to check all of those trash receptacles in Hartford. Unfortunately, some had already been picked up and taken to the dump, but not all of them. They found cut-up clothing and a bra with blood on them, believed to be Jennifer's, plastic zip ties with blood, and other household items, including a sponge that had blood stains on it. Another piece of CCTV footage shows Fotis putting a large white-colored item into a storm drain on Albany Avenue. And when police looked into the drain, they found a large white FedEx envelope containing two Connecticut passenger license plates. So these plates had been altered with some blue tape and some paint. And once the tape was removed, the plates were identified as actual expired plates from four group vehicles. So this was definitely suspicious.
I guess
he had no idea that he would be seen on camera. Although the way I look at it, whenever I'm out on a city street or anything like that, I just assume that I'm being watched. Maybe not personally watched, but recorded for sure.
You probably are.
Yeah.
At various places.
Yeah.
But he's just dumping stuff kind of nonchalantly.
I know. But I mean, even like in our neighborhood, half the people have those Ring doorbells or they have security cameras.
Right.
So I just would always think that you're on camera. So I think this was kind of stupid that he didn't realize that.
Well, at least I'm thinking.
Yeah, but this just seemed like it was a planned out crime against Jennifer and not planned out very well, I guess.
Well, they got some of it down right and the rest they messed up.
Yeah.
In this plan.
Sure. But based on these findings, detectives got arrest warrants for both Fotis and Michelle. On June 1st, they were charged with tampering with or fabricating physical evidence and for hindering prosecution in the first degree. Now, they both made bail and they were released, but at this point they know that they're being watched.
Yeah, they've got to know that they are strongly persons of interest, right?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Back on the 24th of May, when Jennifer first went missing, the New Canaan police had left several messages on Michelle Traconis' phone, which she never responded to. So the police finally had their first interview with her on June 2nd, the day after she had been arrested. And her attorney was with her during the questioning. She would offer several different versions of the events on May 24th. Here's her first version.
Okay. So, she said that she and Fotis woke up at 6:40 a.m. at their residence at 4 Jefferson Crossing. She said that they showered and had sex before she made breakfast for her daughter and then drove her daughter to school. Now, this is inconsistent with the data on Fotis's cell phone, which showed that his alarm went off at 4:20 a.m. and was shut off at 4:21 a.m. When pushed for more specifics, Traconis admitted that maybe Fotis wasn't home the entire morning, but she did still give him an alibi for 6:40 a.m. to 8:15 a.m. that morning. She said that she saw him that morning at 8:15 in the Four Group office, with his lawyer, or former lawyer and friend, Kent Mawinney. She said that she was out of the house from 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. after that. But Kent Mawinney was Fotis's friend, and he was also a founding member of the Windsor Rod and Gun Club. Now remember, that's where they found that grave.
That's where the grave is.
He had actually helped with the purchase of that property for the club, and in May of 2019... he was no longer a member there. But that spring, Ken had called a current member of the club and asked him about rejoining. He'd asked some different questions about the property, and the member trusted him, so he told Kent where a key to the property's gate could be found. So we know that Kent had access to that club and that land. And he never did apply to rejoin the club, so we wonder if maybe that was just an excuse to get access.
Yeah, it would look like that, wouldn't it?
Yeah, he's a very suspicious man. He's creepy.
Well, he had become estranged from his wife after she had accused him of spousal rape. And then not too long after that, Fotis reached out to Mawinney's wife in order to try to convince her to reconcile with him. And she barely knew Fotis, so it seemed odd for him to contact her. And she told him that any communication between her and Kent had to go through their attorneys. But Fotis tried to convince her to come with him to his house and talk. And this frightened her, and she refused. And so she did go to the police, and she told law enforcement that she was afraid Mawinney and Fotis Doulos were working together to kill her.
Yeah, she got that feeling. And like we said, you've got to trust your gut.
Right. Because remember, a shallow grave had been found at the club, but no body was ever found. So our first thought was that it was for Jennifer, but it could have been prepared for Mrs. Mawinney.
Exactly. Or it could have been a plot between Mawinney and Fotis Doulos to kill both of their wives, although that would have been stupid.
That would have been.
Would have made them doubly suspicious to have both wives turn up dead. But when police went to the site on June 21st, so a lot of time had passed, the bags of lime were already gone and the hole had been refilled with dirt. So we know that someone was aware of that setup there and had returned to it to take the lime and refill it. There was no evidence found when they dug up that hole, so I'm thinking whoever had it ready had gone back and decided it's not going to work, I need to cover it up.
Yeah. Now, when confronted about the video footage of her and Fotis driving around in the Raptor, with Fotis depositing garbage bags in different trash receptacles, Michelle says she didn't know what he'd been putting in the receptacles. She said they had gone to Hartford to go to a Starbucks. But the truck never stopped at a Starbucks. It did stop at several trash receptacles and showed Fotis dropping off several bags, but no Starbucks.
Yeah, so I definitely feel like she has some guilt here. Definitely. In her second interview, Michelle avoided questions about Fotis's whereabouts completely, but then she ended up admitting that she didn't see him on May 24th until 1 or 2 p.m., When asked if there was any tension in their relationship because of his divorce, she said, well, yeah, we fight all the time.
Jeez.
She said that Fotis had told her of Jennifer, sometimes I hope she disappears. So that's not good.
Yeah, she's going to change her story yet another time. In a third interview, Michelle said that Fotis was not at the house when she woke up at 6:40 in the morning on the 24th, and she said she had lied about the shower and the sex and hadn't seen him at all. Then when asked if Mawinney was in the four group office on the morning of the 24th, she said yes, he was. She said he had had a meeting that morning with Fotis, and she acknowledged that Fotis's cell phone was sitting in the four group office with Mawinney, and when it rang, Mawinney stood up and told her to answer it. Now, this turned out to be from a friend of Fotis in Athens, but she said that she heard static when she answered and it was hard to hear anything. She said she heard the Greek word for hello, and she responded with the Spanish word for hello. This call only lasted for a few seconds, and the data showed a 17-second call. And after the call, she left the office and left the cell phone there.
So she was trying to play it like it was normal for him to leave his cell phone behind, but I find that hard to believe. Especially a business person, you live by your cell phone.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's this big hotshot developer. He's not going to miss calls.
And this call from Athens definitely seems like a setup, like they were trying to create some alibi that, well, he was home and he was actually on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
But now we know that he wasn't there, but he left his phone there, which definitely seems like it was done on purpose with this setup phone call. And it certainly feels like Mawinney was in on it, and he knew exactly what he was doing.
Right. I mean, telling her to pick up the phone and answer it.
Yeah.
Right?
Sure. But she had several alibis for herself for the morning of May 24th, including footage of herself at a store, and then she dropped by a friend's house and took some photos with her phone. When asked if she could confirm Fotis's location that morning, she finally admitted that she couldn't. And she did continue to claim, though, that it was not unusual for him to leave his phone behind or for her to not see him for an entire morning. So she's still trying to cover things up.
Yeah, she's maybe not actually outright lying, but she's stretching the truth.
Oh, I think she's lying.
With the story. But then she says, you know, it's not that unusual for me not to see him in the morning.
Right, but she'd had a whole story made up, right?
Oh, she did.
And we're going to find out that that story had been worked out and actually written down.
By using CCTV footage, footage from school buses in the area, and cell phone pings, police are able to put together a timeline for Fotis on May 24th. So he woke up at 4:20 in the morning. 1 hour later, he drove an employee's red Toyota Tacoma to a preserve near Jennifer's home in New Canaan. And he took his vintage Mercier French racing bike from the back of the Tacoma and rode the bike to Jennifer's house around 7:30.
Yeah, so there were residential cameras that saw someone matching his description riding that bike in that direction.
Right. Now, it was quiet at the house because Jennifer had left to take the kids to school. At 8:05, Jennifer can be seen pulling into the driveway in the Suburban, entering the garage and closing the door with the remote.
Yeah, so according to the investigators, Fotis was actually lying in wait for Jennifer inside the garage. He restrained her with zip ties around her ankles and wrists, and then he stabbed her with a murder weapon that hasn't been recovered, so we don't know what he used. After cleaning up using those 10 rolls of paper towels, he put Jennifer and his bike into the Suburban, and then he drove it back to the preserve where he had parked the Tacoma. So he left the lights on in the Suburban, perhaps setting it up to look like an abduction. Then he put the bike and Jennifer's body into the Tacoma, and he was back in Farmington to have lunch with Michelle at 1:37 when his phone pinged there.
Yeah, so even though Fotis wasn't arrested right away for murder, he was definitely one of the prime suspects, if not the prime suspect. The blood in the garage and on the items found in trash barrels in Hartford were identified as Jennifer's. Fotis had also left a speck of blood containing his DNA on the faucet in her kitchen and on the interior doorknob of the mudroom. And also on the evening of Jennifer's disappearance, Fotis and Michelle were recorded dropping evidence into trash receptacles. When police searched the local dump for trash that had already been picked up from receptacles, they found duct tape, zip ties, ponchos, and some of Jennifer's clothing, including a bra and a t-shirt.
Investigators also found crumpled papers in the Jefferson Crossing house, which had what police called alibi scripts written on them. And these had a timeline of what Michelle and Fotis said they wanted the police to believe they had done that day. The originals were in the trash, but there were also copies in a briefcase in the four-group office. So that seems really careless and stupid.
That's just dumb.
Yeah. When asked about them, Michelle said that she had just made notes because her attorney suggested she do that to remember what she had done that day. So she was saying it wasn't made up. It was just something that the attorney had told her and Fotis to do so they wouldn't forget the timeline. But it's not looking good.
It certainly isn't. Now, the search for Jennifer continued. Dogs were brought into the Farmington and New Canaan homes, and the incineration plant in Hartford was shut down for a time so the cadaver dogs could search there. But no trace of her was found. The evidence was quite overwhelming against Fotis, but his attorney put together what he called a vigorous defense. He speculated to police and the media that Jennifer was responsible for her own disappearance. He described her as a troubled woman and suggested that she may have pulled a scam like the woman in the book and movie Gone Girl.
Which is just ridiculous, can I say?
Sure, go ahead.
I mean, it would
is be, ridiculous.
Yeah, be pretty much impossible. That's a movie. Plus, this isn't a woman who's going to leave her kids.
No.
No. So a spokesperson for Jennifer's family responded by saying, "This is not fiction or a movie. This is real life, as experienced every day by Jennifer's 5 young children, her family, and her friends. We are heartbroken." So on May 31st, Fotis and Michelle went to a barbecue with friends in Avon, Connecticut. When they showed up, the friends were surprised. It's only been like a week since Jennifer went missing. The host of the barbecue asked them to leave, saying, "You know, it just seems inappropriate for you to be here together when Jennifer's missing." But they just didn't seem to care. They decided to stay. And when a friend asked Fotis where Jennifer was, he just talked about her having over $15,000 in medical bills, kind of suggesting that she would have fled. But we know for these people, $15,000 was not a lot of money.
No. Drop in the bucket.
Kind of, yeah. When one of the guest's cell phones went off with a breaking news alert, he showed it to Fotis, and it said that police were finding evidence from a New Canaan case in Hartford. So Fotis looked up the story on his phone, and then he left the barbecue. The next day is when he and Michelle were arrested on the tampering with evidence charges. So let's talk about Fotis's employee, Paul Gumieni.
Yeah, he's the owner of the red Toyota Tacoma that Fotis used in carrying out his plot to kill Jennifer and in the cover-up.
Exactly. He was the project manager at the Ford Group, and on May 24th, Paul drove one of the company cars to a Ford Group construction site on Sturbridge Hill Road in New Canaan, and he was there all day, so he's not a suspect at all. But there's a lot of stuff going on with his Toyota Tacoma.
Yeah, detectives spoke with him on May 31st when they were at Fotis's house in Farmington. He said he had removed two seats from an old Porsche at Fotis's direction to replace the seats in his Toyota Tacoma. Now, do they fit? I mean, I can't believe that Porsche seats work in a truck.
Well, it fit. Apparently, he'd gone to a junkyard and couldn't find any appropriate ones. And so Fotis gave him these old Porsche seats.
Okay. He told investigators that he typically left his truck at Fotis's Farmington house, and he would use a company car while he went to do work in different locations. So this would mean that Fotis had access to the Tacoma on May 24th as well as other days. On the 24th, in fact, Fotis and Michelle had possession of the Tacoma keys and tried to convince Paul to leave the Tacoma behind and take the company Raptor home for the weekend. He had gone to the Mountain Spring Road property after he saw his Tacoma was not at the Jefferson Crossing house where he left it. This was about 4:30 in the afternoon. He saw both Michelle and Fotis standing outside in the driveway, and they seemed surprised to see him.
Right. So their whole idea here was that they were cleaning the house, and number one, I don't believe that he cleaned his own houses. Not for a second.
Of course not.
No. So Fotis and Paul drove to some other properties, but when they returned to Mountain Spring Road, the key that Paul had seen in the Tacoma's passenger side door was now gone. So the Tacoma was there, but he didn't have a key for it. And Michelle had taken the key. This is when Fotis really tried to convince him to take one of his trucks. But Paul insisted that Michelle bring him his keys because he wanted to put his dirt bike in it and go somewhere that weekend. So finally, Fotis agreed. They gave him back his keys, and he left with his Tacoma. So he was starting to act really funny about that truck.
He was. Well, then he told the police that several days after Jennifer's disappearance, Fotis had taken his Tacoma to a car wash to have the interior detailed and the exterior washed. So Fotis told him that the Tacoma seats were not the original Toyota seats, so Paul could change the seats or just sell the truck. He had never cleaned Paul's truck before, and certainly replacing the seats made no sense whatever.
Right, and Paul was getting suspicious.
To say the least.
Then also on May 28th, he had found a red bucket and a dark blue hoodie in the back of his Tacoma. He had assumed these belonged to Fotis, so he just moved them into the Jefferson Crossing house's laundry room. But then this wasn't found afterwards, so someone had taken care of it. Over a few days' time, Fotis repeatedly told Paul to remove the Tacoma's seats and replace them, and he was very pushy about it. When the seats hadn't been replaced yet, he had actually gotten really angry, and he told Paul that in future phone calls, he should only refer to the seats as hardware. So he's suspicious, but for fear of losing his job, Paul went ahead and changed the seats. But he found the whole thing suspicious, so what he did is he kept the seats in case the police needed them in the future. If he'd thrown them away, he could actually have been in trouble.
Oh, yeah, he could be an accessory.
Exactly.
Now, when he asked Fotis why he wanted the seats changed, Fotis said that he had hugged Jennifer when he was with the kids on May 23rd, and he was afraid that one of her hairs might be in the Tacoma seats.
It was determined by investigators that Fotis and Michelle rode together in the Tacoma on May 29th to a car wash that was located in Avon, Connecticut. Fotis paid $250 in cash to have the Tacoma cleaned without consulting the owner, Paul. There is CCTV footage of Fotis entering the lobby and filling out a log sheet. He wrote down that the vehicle was a Toyota Sienna, even though he knew it was a Tacoma, and the space for his name he left blank. For the phone number to contact, he left Michelle's cell number. So there's something evasive about the whole thing. I don't think most people would pay $250 in cash either. Most people would use a debit or credit card.
On June 6th, the Tacoma was seized and searched, and Paul voluntarily gave the police the seats that he had replaced. These were sent out for forensic testing, and lo and behold, Jennifer's blood was identified on the passenger seat. So it wasn't one of her hairs.
No, and she wouldn't have hugged him. Things were not going well between them.
Nope.
No. Well, when speaking to Paul, he told the police that Fotis owned an older model bicycle that he had brought with him when he moved to the United States. The bike was a Mercier bike that he had owned since he was a child. It had been kept on a hook in the garage of the 4 Jefferson Crossing house for as long as Paul could remember. But then during a search of that house on June 3rd, the bike had been missing. Evidence found in the Albany Avenue trash receptacles would turn out to include a logo from a vintage Mercier bike. And photos from 2008 of the interior of the garage showed a bike matching this description on a hook. On the day Jennifer disappeared, residential surveillance cameras showed that someone dressed in a hooded sweatshirt riding this type of bike towards Jennifer's home. And it was kind of easy to identify because it was an unusual bike. How many people own one of those? It also had those ram horn-like handlebars that used to be really popular on 10 speeds.
Well, they're still fairly popular.
Well, these were a little bit weird, but yeah.
But yeah, it's a French bike.
Yeah.
And not too many people in Connecticut have one of those.
No, fairly rare. And especially with a route that was taken and the person matching the description of Fotis.
Now, as part of their investigation, the police were allowed to look at Fotis's financials. They noted the lawsuit with his mother-in-law, and this showed between $1.5 and $2.5 million that was disputed that he owed her. He also had multiple lines of credit. This included nearly $4.5 million in mortgages against his properties. This balance was due to be paid by May 31st, 2019.
So that, wow, to me is like a huge red flag.
Isn't it?
So he really didn't have any money. He was in debt.
No, because he also had a credit line with a bank under the name of the Four Group, and that had an outstanding balance of $2.6 million and checking account advances totaling $1.6 million. So the Four Group business account was being funded by a line of credit totaling over $500,000. So Fotis is pretty deeply in a hole. I mean, he probably can't even see out of the hole.
Exactly. But each of his children had a trust fund that had been put together by Jennifer's parents. And the total amount of that was over $2 million. So that could have helped him out quite a bit, because if he got custody of the kids after Jennifer disappeared, he could access that money for, you know, expenses for the children. Jennifer's financial records indicate that she wasn't alive after May 24th as well. Her last activity was a check that she wrote on May 23rd, and there'd been no further activity on any of her known accounts. So Fotis Doulos released a public statement that July, and he said that he understands the public's perception of him as a monster, given the little that they know about the case. But he added, "I trust the system and the process and ask the public to do the same. My children are the center of my world," he said. "I worry about them and Jennifer, and I would tell them that I know it's hard now, but everything is going to be all right eventually."
What a concerned, caring father.
I know. He's husband. Got a lot of nerve to even say that stuff.
On August 15th, 2019, the lead detective in Jennifer's case met with the chief medical examiner for the state of Connecticut. Following their conversation on all of the evidence, the medical examiner said that based on the facts of the investigation, the degree of blood loss, and the DNA evidence, it was his belief that Jennifer had sustained injuries which he would consider non-survivable without medical intervention. He categorized her status as a victim of homicide, of violence, related to some combination of blunt force trauma and or sharp force injury from a stabbing.
So, of course, this is devastating to her family and friends and the children.
Yeah, because you're still probably holding out some sliver of hope that she's alive.
Absolutely, they were. And just the thought that she'd lost that much blood is really depressing and upsetting. Then in September of 2019, both Fotis and Michelle were arrested again on another charge of tampering with evidence. And they both pleaded not guilty, and again they were out on bail. Fotis was still waiting for the indictment for murder, more than 9 months after Jennifer had disappeared. Even with Michelle's testimony, the state really needed time to make a case without a body or a murder weapon. By this time, Fotis and Michelle had broken up, and he had a new girlfriend, Anna Curry, who was living with him at Jefferson Crossing. But he was becoming depressed, perhaps realizing that he was likely to spend the rest of his life in prison. He really tried to charm the media, as he maintained that he was innocent, but the stories on the case all ended up showing him in a very negative light. So things just weren't going the way he thought they would.
Not at all. Fotis couldn't leave his house without being recognized and harassed. In December, a guy showed up at his house and told him he too was without his family over the holidays, so Fotis invited him in for a drink. They talked for hours, but then the man later tried to sell secret tape recordings of his conversation with Fotis to the press.
So the thought of him inviting a stranger in for a drink like that makes me think he was getting really depressed and lonely.
Oh, yeah.
But it's all his fault. He's got nobody to blame but himself, obviously.
Yeah, now Fotis was taken into custody by the Connecticut State Police at his home on January 7th, 2020, and he was charged with capital murder, felony murder, and kidnapping. His bond was set at $6 million. Michelle Traconis was arrested for conspiracy to commit murder. Her bond was set at $2 million. Her attorney was able to get that lowered to $1.5 million. Kent Mawinney was arrested and charged with conspiracy to commit murder. Fotis and Michelle posted bond. Mawinney remained in jail.
Yeah, after she posted her bail, Michelle was taken to the emergency room. Now, police said that this was a medical evaluation that was a condition of her being released from jail. But she also had been on the medical wing of the jail for 2 days while she was locked up there. Of course, medical records haven't been released to the public, but she was released from the hospital that same day she made bail, so we don't know exactly what was going on with her health-wise. The cynical part of me tends to believe she just didn't want to have to be in the regular jail, so she came up with something.
That's a good thought.
Yeah, I don't know how easy that is, though, because I would think people working in a jail are pretty skeptical about buying that stuff. And then also within weeks, Fotis's bail was in question. Authorities determined that the properties that he had put up for bond were not actually his. Some of them...
Whoops.
Yeah. Some of the money, including $147,000 in cash and a $3 million promissory note secured by his girlfriend, Anna Curry, were also found to be not acceptable. So he's going to end up going to jail. Is what he's facing.
He's going back to jail because he's not going to be able to make bond.
Right. But on the morning of January 28, when he learned that his bond would probably be revoked at a hearing in court later that day, he was not very happy, and his attorney told Fotis he was likely to be in jail throughout his entire trial. At 10:30 a.m. that day, he sent his girlfriend out of the house to run an errand, and then he went into his garage. He attached a vacuum hose to the exhaust pipe of his Suburban, put the other end of the hose in a car window, and started the engine. And in a really kind of unemotional suicide note, which he wrote on a yellow legal pad, he wrote, "If you are reading this, I am no more. I refuse to spend even an hour in jail for something I had nothing to do with. Enough is enough. If it takes my head to end this, so be it." Then he claimed that Kent Mawinney and Michelle Traconis had nothing to do with Jennifer's disappearance either, and he apologized to Anna Curry for letting her down. For his kids, he wrote, "Please let my children know that I love them. I would do anything to be with them, but unfortunately we all have our limits.
Yeah, now concerned that he hadn't shown up for the bail hearing, police were sent to Fotis's home to check on him. No one answered the door, but when an officer looked into the garage window, he saw Fotis slumped over in his car. So within minutes of the ambulance's arrival at the house, the news of Fotis had attempted suicide was on the news. After resuscitation attempts, he did have a faint, thready pulse. He was airlifted to a hospital in the Bronx that had a hyperbaric chamber. Now, his sister Rena was on the next plane from Athens. And a group of his friends and family were at the hospital praying for his life, but he did not survive.
Right. So can you just tell us briefly a little bit about what was happening to him and how a hyperbaric chamber may have helped and why he wouldn't survive?
Well, he's breathing carbon monoxide, which displaces oxygen from the hemoglobin molecule, so basically he's suffocating. The hyperbaric chamber is a way to get basically high-dose oxygen into a person. So they're inside the chamber with a lot greater oxygen than the 21% that's in room air.
So they must have determined he was brain dead and had him on the machines, because they did bring the children in to say goodbye to him.
Yeah, I would think that if he's unconscious, unresponsive, and not much going on mentally, yeah, he was gone.
Well, one of Jennifer's friends called Fotis's death a Rumpelstiltskin suicide, and that meant an action by a narcissist who can't reconcile his grandiose sense of self with who he really is and the reality of his situation. With this suicide attempt, Fotis once and again turned the focus back to himself, and he also took away any chance of closure for Jennifer's family and friends. You know, I'm not sure I believe in closure, but I think it would be important for them to know where Jennifer's body was and what exactly had happened to her.
Yes, it would.
And he really didn't show any concern about leaving his children without a parent at all. He just doesn't seem like a very loving father. Well, of course, anyone who would kill their mother is not a loving father anyway.
That's correct. And any father who pushes his kids to a sport or an activity where they're talking to mom about, we can't do this, we're so unhappy, that's not good.
Yeah, they were young. Yeah. We're not even talking about teenagers.
Nope.
No.
So Vanessa Grigoriadis of Vanity Fair described Fotis's actions as what could be called a slow-motion murder-suicide. Just a variation of the typical story of domestic violence ending in murder.
Yeah, even though he owned a cemetery plot next to his mother's in Connecticut, his family had concerns about his grave being desecrated if he was buried there. So they decided to cremate him, and his ashes were sent to Greece. But if you set aside the wealthy lifestyle of Jennifer and Fotis, Jennifer's murder really isn't very different from other domestic partners who've suffered and died at the hands of their abusers. So it's the old adage, money can't buy happiness.
No, it can't. Michelle Traconis and Kent Mowinney will be going on trial for conspiracy to commit murder and other charges.
Well, Michelle's attorney has said that she will concede that the woman seen on camera with Fotis when he was disposing of garbage bags in Hartford was her. But he said Michelle didn't know what was in the bags. And I find that terribly hard to believe. According to Michelle, she had frequently witnessed Fotis throwing things in public dumpsters to avoid paying for trash removal. But that does not make sense. This is not large mattresses and large things. This is little bags of stuff.
That's right.
And why would you throw them in little trash cans separately around the city?
Well, that's a hard one to answer. I don't think I have that.
Well, I guess they must have thought that in the city, there's a lot going on and nobody will notice it, not considering that they would be on camera. So I think that really surprised them.
Yeah, I suspect that they just didn't think there were going to be cameras recording them. I don't know how you'd think that, but
I don't know, really. These are supposed to be intelligent people. Although I think there's really an aspect of rage in him doing that. So when you're in rage like that, you're not thinking clearly.
True.
And I think pretty much every murder we've ever talked about has had a really, well, some stupidity to it.
Oh, yeah.
And it just usually does not work out. Things get worse.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Jennifer's body hasn't been found, and her children continue to live with Jennifer's mother. So I just hope for their sake they're able to find her.
Yeah, I don't know how they'll ever find her.
Do you have any ideas in your mind where they could have hidden her body?
As you said earlier, where the Suburban was, if you look at a 40-minute circle around there, she's in there someplace.
I kind of believe that he didn't know the phone was in the Suburban, and Jennifer was taken somewhere to be disposed of away from that area.
Right, but there's still, from one ping to the next ping, there was a 40-minute time.
No, it wasn't from ping to ping. It was just that the phone was there for 40 minutes before it was shut down.
Okay.
So if the phone was sitting in the Suburban and he didn't know it, or in one of her pockets or something.
Doesn't narrow it down any.
No. But I really think that that 40-minute period is when her body was gotten rid of somewhere. So we know that her body is probably in a 40-minute range of the Waverly Park.
Yeah, but that's still, while it narrows it down some, there's still probably a ton of places her body could be.
Oh, sure, yeah. Really difficult to say. So our sources for this case are the State of Connecticut Superior Court documents, a Vanity Fair article, Fates and Furies, and that's from October 15th, 2020, by Vanessa Grigoriadis. There's also a TV special, Vanished in New Canaan, an ID mystery. And there's a great book called Nobody Homicide Cases, a practical guide to investigating, prosecuting, and winning cases when the victim is missing. And that's by Thomas A. DiBiase, a former prosecutor. And he has a fascinating website, nobodycases.com. TCB's music was written and produced by Tristan Capel. If you enjoy our shows, please consider leaving us a review on iTunes or wherever it is that you listen. If you visit our website, tygrabber.com, you could also do a little Christmas or Hanukkah shopping. We have a lot of warm winter gear and masks with our logo and other cool stuff on them. And, you know, you can also subscribe to our members-only show, True Crime Brewery Premium, by going to our website, tygrabber.com. As a member, you'll have a new bonus episode each and every month, ad-free versions of our weekly show, access to over 40 bonus episodes, and, of course, a gift with a handwritten thank you note. And once you're a member, you don't have to listen to these self-promotions from me anymore. All right, Dick, let's do feedback. First, we have a case suggestion from Cindy.
Our friend Cindy, she likes to write us. We like to hear from her.
Yep.
So she wants us to do a podcast on Carla Faye Tucker. She killed two people with a pickaxe in 1983 and was sentenced to death for those killings. And she was actually put to death by lethal injection in 1998. She's the first woman in Texas to be put to death in like 135 years, something like that.
Now, I know there was a lot of publicity about this because she had really said that she turned herself around in prison.
She had.
She was very religious and doing good things.
Found the Lord and was doing good things.
Yeah. So it's really kind of sad to me. Not a big death penalty proponent anyway. And a lot of people were against it. Because what good did it do to put her to death? So that would definitely be an interesting story.
It is. It's a very interesting story. She had an absolutely horrible life.
Yeah, that's another thing. Is that she was kind of set up to have a miserable life.
She was.
Yeah. Okay, well, our next one is a case suggestion from Jennifer. And she writes, "Hi, Jill and Dick. I stumbled on your podcast when I saw a post on Facebook in regards to the Hart family case. I didn't know your podcast was about true crime. Sad to say, my fascination with the Hart family grew when I listened to the podcast called Broken Hearts. I also read the article about this family called One Unthinkable Tragedy, A Look Inside the Perfect Hart Family. This article was posted in Glamour Magazine." And Glamour Magazine is also the ones that did the podcast Broken Hearts, because we listened to that.
We listened to that.
Mm-hmm.
That was excellent.
So Jennifer goes on, "I'm a therapist, and I work for a designated agency in South Burlington, Vermont. The Hart family tragedy struck me hard because I work in the substance use arena. I think the biological mom of Dante, Jeremiah, and Sierra was a prime example of racism, and I think we would definitely agree with that.
Oh, we certainly would.
Sherry Davis deserved so much more, and so did her children. After exploring and listening to your stories, I decided to become a member. I love your storytelling and your thoughts. I don't drink beer hardly ever anymore. I'm in recovery, and I've limited myself to a few beers a year. But boy, I do appreciate a great stout. As a master's level professional in the mental health and substance use field, I still consider myself a peer at heart. I spend my days listening to your podcast while I write notes and study for my prerequisite classes. I plan to apply to become a nurse practitioner in 2021, and I hope one day to prescribe Suboxone and give back to those who have suffered from addiction like myself. Here's my case suggestion. Ann Scripps Douglas. She was an heiress to the Scripps newspaper. At the time of her murder, she resided in Bronxville, New York, and this is a story about domestic violence, and it really hits close to home. I remember hearing about this tragedy when I lived in NYC. She was murdered in her home. My second case suggestion, after watching the movie Foxcatcher, I became interested in the true story murder of Dave Schultz and his murderer slash employer, John DuPont. John was born into the DuPont family fortune, and John DuPont had a really unhealthy obsession with Olympic wrestling. He tragically murdered Dave Schultz, who was employed by him to train his wrestling team at his Foxcatcher Center. And I would like to hear your rendition of these two cases. So what do you think, Dickie? These are some good suggestions.
They certainly are. The thing with Ann Scripps, her second husband was the person who killed her, who murdered her. He had a long history of domestic violence, and she had tried to get a restraining order against him that was denied. But it's one of those things that should have been avoidable. He shouldn't have been allowed near her. But he did, and he killed her.
Well, I would say the same about John DuPont. He had severe mental illness, was very unstable, walking around with a gun.
Yeah, he was way off in the ether someplace.
Yes. So that was very dangerous, and there should have been some kind of intervention, but there wasn't.
No. Well, maybe in both cases, but certainly in the DuPont case, he's a wealthy guy.
Very wealthy. So, I mean, that's how he was able to do this. He built this area. He paid these people.
Right. But I think that maybe you're less likely to get taken in for domestic violence if you're wealthy.
Oh, yeah. That's true. I think you get away with a lot.
Yeah.
But not murder most of the time.
It was a good movie.
It was a good movie. There was the movie with Steve Carell.
That's the movie.
Okay, but there's also a documentary on Netflix that I've watched.
Yeah.
It has the real people.
Steve Carell was John DuPont, and Dave Schultz was Mark Ruffalo.
Oh, well, who was Channing Tatum in that? He was a big part of it.
He was the other brother.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that was so tragic. All right, well, there we go. That's it for feedback. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And we'll see you next time at the quiet end.
We'll be saving seats for you because there's plenty of room down here. Getting quieter and quieter at the quiet end.
Certainly is. I miss hanging out at the bar and talking to people. But we're going to stick with it. There is a light at the end of a long tunnel.
There is.
Yep. Okay.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Bye-bye.